So we understand that Jesus Christ lived a fully human life. It's one of the core beliefs and faith that we have, that he lived a fully human existence, having emptied himself of his eternal glory and became a living, breathing, physical man on this earth. I've been contemplating something lately that I'll share with you in the message today. How does, or how can, Jesus relate to me if he has never been in my exact position in life? If he's never been exactly in my shoes, he didn't have my parents, he didn't have my upbringing, he doesn't have my body, he doesn't have my family, doesn't have my health issues. How can he actually relate to me if he's never been in my shoes exactly? He was never married physically on this earth, so how can he relate to marriage? He did not have children on this earth. How can he relate to the sleepless nights and the care for a child? He was not a woman on this earth. How can he relate to women? He did not face the exact temptations that I struggle with, in theory. So how can he understand that? You know, he didn't live in a time that I live in. He didn't live in this modern time. He didn't walk the earth in this modern time. So how does he understand things like technology and social media and temptations related to all of that, or the pulls and stresses of this earth now, in this time? He did not live past the age of 33. So how does he know what it's like to get old? How does he know what it's like to have an aging body, an aging mind? As far as we know, he didn't deal with an ongoing trial of health. We understand the crucifixion, but an ongoing chronic disease, he didn't deal with that. Or as far as we know, financially, he doesn't talk a lot, but did he have to deal with an ongoing financial trial or a family trial? We don't see all of those details of his life, but there's not a lot of evidence to support that. So how can he actually relate to me if he doesn't know exactly what I'm going through? Like exactly what I'm going through. These are sometimes questions that might arise in our heads and could really lead to doubt, could lead to doubt in the ability of God to do a work in our life. And I'll come back to these questions at the end, but sometimes I think these things, and maybe sometimes you think these things. How could he actually understand what I'm going through? He doesn't know what it's like to be living in 2024 and being over the age of 33, right? So there's a couple of passages I want to go to, like as I said earlier, contemplate this concept. But also, we're going to go to a couple of examples in his physical life, to see maybe a little more insight into what it means to understand how he relates to us as humans. Let's first go to Hebrews chapter 2. Hebrews 2, verse 10. These are verses we often review heading into the Passover, and it's appropriate that we review them heading into the Passover, because it does point to his humanity. It does point to his ability to understand and relate to us. Hebrews 2, verse 10. For it was fitting for him, for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified are all of one. for which reason he is not ashamed to call them brethren. We're kind of cutting into this passage here, this whole introduction to Hebrews. But it's pointing us back to the work of salvation. The work that God is doing towards salvation for all mankind. For you and I right now, but for all mankind. Pointing that Jesus is the author or the one who paved the trail, the originator. He paved the trail of it because he obtained it. He obtained salvation as a human being, just as we obtain salvation as a human being. His salvation was the same basis that ours is. He could have sinned. He could have died. And this is part of being in his family. You know, he's not ashamed to call us brethren. He's not ashamed to relate to us on this level because he lived on this level as a human. It's part of being of the God kind. Go on to verse 12. Saying, and then he quotes here from Psalm 22 and Isaiah 8, saying, I will declare your name to my brethren. In the midst of the assembly, I will sing praise to you. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, here am I and the children whom God has given me. Pointing again to this bigger picture of salvation and a family that he's building. This is all for the purpose of family. I just want to make a comment here as these verses are quoted. Psalm 22 and Isaiah 8, these are originally written by human, normal humans, if you will, non-Jesus humans. So David in Psalm 22, for example. David was a human just like us, and he experienced that level of angst and depravity and all of those things as a human. And I just find it really interesting that Jesus, when the author of Hebrews, likely Paul, is talking here about Jesus, he's not pointing to something in Jesus' life. He's pointing to the life of someone who everybody knows lived a fully human life, King David in this case. And that's the basis by which we are to understand Jesus' life is off of that. The experience that David experienced is very, very similar. The same feelings, the same anxieties, the same frustrations as the life that Jesus experienced. And that's kind of the benchmark that's set here. Verse 14, inasmuch as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, that's you and I, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. We are all subject to bondage. And we are actively partaking of flesh and blood. We are actively human. The part that follows that, he himself likewise shared in the same. That term for shared is really interesting. Because it indicates, the meaning there is to take hold of something that's not related to your own kind. To take hold of something that's not related to your own kind. Jesus was not of the mankind, he's of the God kind. And he emptied himself, as we read in Philippians 2, to partake of being a human. Of being a fully physical human. I was trying to think of an analogy here, and this is a poor one. You know I'm not great at analogies. But if I were going to release of my humanity and become like a dog, become the dog kind, the canine kind, some might argue I'm already there in my household. But if I'm going to empty myself of being a human and become a dog, I'm going to change. There's things about me that will change. I won't have the same abilities. I won't have the ability to think and discern the way a human does. I will also live in this fully physical existence. I'll start smelling things I've never smelled before. And I'll start hearing things I've never heard before. and now I'll go to the bathroom the way I never did before, right? Because that's what it means to be a dog. And I'm not trying to say we're dogs, but when Jesus emptied himself of his eternal glory and power, it's we almost can't comprehend it. When he emptied himself of all of that knowledge and power and ability and perfection, and then he had to come here and be a human. What a significant change that was for him. Significant change it was for him. And then in verse 16, we see why he did this. For indeed, he does not give aid to angels, but he does give aid to the seed of Abraham. Or he has a nature as the seed of Abraham. Therefore, in all things, he had to be made like his brethren, that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For in that, he himself has suffered being tempted, and he is able to aid those who are tempted. It's talking about temptation. It's also talking about testing and just about being a human. He's able to aid because he knows what it's like to be a human. And it's in all things. In all things he had to be made like his brethren. So all means all. It means every aspect. So that's one kind of passage to kind of start thinking through this concept. Does he really know what I'm feeling? Does he really know what I'm going through? This is a concept of faith. We must believe, without a doubt, that Jesus, and by extension the Father, can relate to us as individuals, fully and completely, physically, intellectually, emotionally, and spiritually. Let's go to another passage to think through this concept. Hebrews 5, saying in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 5, verse 5. Hebrews 5, verse 5. So also, Christ did not glorify himself to become a high priest. So the end of that last passage in Hebrews 2, we pointed to this idea of a high priest, and that's a whole study in and of itself of what it means to be a high priest. But we understand it generally as the mediator between God and man, an act of service, an advocate, all of those things. But it was he who said to him, again, quoting something written by a, quote, normal human, written by David, if you are my son, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. And he also says in another place, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is another topic we won't get into a whole lot. Verse 7, who in the days of his flesh, in his humanity, in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear. Though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Called by God as high priest according to the order of Melchizedek, of whom we have much to say and hard to explain, and it kind of he addresses the Jewish audience there. But in the flesh, Jesus had certain experiences that you and I might have, but also many or arguably most that you and I have never had. We didn't live at his time either. And we didn't have his family. And we didn't have his purpose. But, according to this passage, we can relate to him and he to us. I mean, how many times have you or I prayed with vehement, intense cries to God repeatedly? He had done that. And we learn obedience throughout our life, just as he learned obedience. He learned obedience. He did that through an unwavering humility and submission to his Father. God isn't asking us to do anything that he has not already done. He's not asking us to do anything that he has not already done. It is, however, important to acknowledge the divinity of Christ. Because we also must understand, because we, you know, sometimes I read the Gospels and I read life and I'm thinking, he's doing miracle after miracle, and he's you know, reading people's minds on occasion, or he knows something. But there's also times he doesn't know stuff. He has to ask questions, or he has to go to God with vehement cries and ask him. That we know about. This is, you know, what's written for us. But those miracles, those moments where he can read someone's mind, or moments when he is interacting and he has some divine inspiration, it's because he's in complete submission and humility to his Father. He's demonstrating that learned obedience through complete humility and submission. And according to the Father's will, he opened up Christ's mind and gave him that understanding, or allowed him to perform a miracle, or in brought him into the knowledge of what his true will was, because they were so close, they were one. As a human, though, he did not inherently possess those things, those abilities and qualities. He had to have them revealed to him slowly, in the right amount, at the right time, by his Father. And sometimes nothing was revealed to him. Sometimes he didn't know, and he had to go through that. And he was probably thankful for it, because as a human, if God was going to show you everything that he knows, and all of his expanse, and all of his vastness, our minds could not comprehend it at all. Just as him and his human mind could not comprehend it fully the way he did as God, as a spirit being, I should say. So these passages in Hebrews are really critical to our understanding that the intent of Jesus living a fully human existence is to serve as a model for our salvation, and to fulfill his role as a merciful, compassionate high priest, a mediator, an advocate, whatever word you want to use there. So let's spend the rest of the time going through a couple passages in the Gospels in Jesus' physical life that showcase his ability to relate to people who he wasn't walking in their shoes, and he didn't know exactly what they were going through. To showcase his humanity and to, again, his ability to relate to those who are also living in this human existence, those with which he shared in flesh and blood, as it says in Hebrews 2. Let's go to Matthew 9, Matthew chapter 9. I'm just going to go to a couple verses here. Matthew 9:32. This comes at the end of a series of miracles and healings. Verse 32, as they went out, behold, they brought to him a man, mute and demon-possessed. Jesus was neither mute nor demon-possessed. Yet they're bringing this man to him. And when the demon was cast out, and the mute spoke, and the multitudes marveled, saying, it was never like this in Israel, but the Pharisee says, he casts out demons by the ruler of demons. This statement, he casts out demons by the ruler of demons, the principle is not wrong, it's just misapplied here. He can cast out demons because he created angels who then made choices to become demons. He's the creator. He's not the father of the demons, but he still is over him. The principle's not wrong there, but they were against him at this point. Verse 35, then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. Every sickness, every disease. Physical, emotional, mental, whatever that sickness was, and the people would come to him asking for healing. It says he dealt with every one of them in this particular instance. So, didn't matter if it was a man or a woman coming to him. Didn't matter if it was a child or an elderly person. Didn't matter if they were single or married. They came to him, and he took care of all of it. Everyone. Verse 36, but when he saw the multitudes, and this is critical, he was moved with compassion for them. Because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. The indication here is not that they were weary and scattered physically, although that could be the case. It's that they were weary and scattered spiritually. They didn't know who to go to for spiritual healing. And he's moved to compassion for a weary and scattered spiritual state. I can only imagine how much compassion God has right now for this world. Because we are weary and scattered as a world, as a globe. I'm going to dig a little bit into this word compassion because I think it's important. It's only used, I'll get to that. It's a Greek verb and it is long. I will say that. It is a long verb. Splachnidzomai. I won't say it again, but what it means is to be moved in the inward parts, to feel compassion, to be moved in the inward parts. In other words, it's an emotional reaction, and there are times when it even feeds a physical response. It's a very human thing to experience, to be moved in the inward parts. We all know that feeling when you see something or you experience something and it just hits you. It's that pit in your stomach, or it's that moment when you're just, you know, hope you haven't had that kind of moment, but my guess is you have, where you're emptied physically because of something you've experienced. And it says this is Jesus' reaction to these people as a human and as God. He is experiencing this emotional reaction and a physical response to it. What's interesting is this word is only used in the Gospels, and it's only used in reference to Jesus or a parable that refers to Jesus. I'm not saying it's unique to him, but I think it's drawing out his humanity in how he relates to people, how he has compassion on people. People that he wasn't necessarily going through what they were going through, but it didn't mean he didn't have that compassion and that gut reaction for them, because he knew what it was to live with this physical body and in this physical world. Matthew chapter 20. Matthew 20, verses 29. We're going to see this word compassion here. It's another instance of healing. Matthew 20, 29. Now, as they went out of Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the road, when they heard that Jesus was passing by, cried out, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. They're actually pointing to his divinity and his humanity. O Lord, Son of David. And also the fact that they at least have some understanding that he is the Messiah. He's the one sent forth. Then the multitude warned them that they should be quiet, and they cried out all the more, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, Son of David. So Jesus stood still and called them and said, "What do you want me to do for you? What do you want me to do for you?" So shouldn't he know what they need at this point? Shouldn't he know that? I mean, he's God. Or maybe does he want them to converse with him about it? You know, our expectation should not be that God has to know everything going on in our minds and know everything we're experiencing exactly, though he does relate to it, as we're learning. But to come to him, for us to come to him as the one who can do something about it. He can do something about it. What do you want me to do for you? And they said to him, "Lord, that our eyes may be opened." So Jesus had compassion. He had that gut reaction. He had compassion, and he touched their eyes. A very human thing to do. To sit across from someone and touch them. He touched their eyes. And immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. So he's living out this divine purpose on a physical level. But he knew that they needed him to do something, and he wanted to know what that was. Here's another analogy for you. If I'm having trouble with my 2008 F-150, I'm going to call a mechanic. Now, does that mechanic have to also own a 2008 F-150 to know what's wrong with my vehicle? No. They have to know something about trucks or cars. They have to know generally how they work and how they function and how to diagnose them. But I don't have to go searching around on the internet or a phone book for somebody who's got a 2008 F-150. You go to God. We go to God because we know he can solve things. We know he can understand things about us and about our situations. Not because he is wearing my shoes in this exact instance. Let's go to Luke 7. I'll just bring out one quick point here in Luke 7, verse 11. Now it happened the day after that he went into a city called Nain, and many of his disciples went with him in a large crowd. And when he came near the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a large crowd from the city was with her. When the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." He understood this emotional response she was having. "Do not weep." And then he came and touched, there's that touching again, the open coffin, and those who carried him stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And he who was dead sat up and began to speak, and he presented him to his mother. Another example of Christ performing a healing here, actually a resurrection here. What I want to bring out, though, is Jesus has compassion on this situation in passing. He didn't go out and seek it, and they didn't necessarily seek him. He just kind of observed it. He was walking into the city. But Jesus, in all respects, could not, as a human, relate to them because he wasn't a woman, he wasn't a widow, and he didn't have a child. And yet he did relate to them in this situation. He related completely to them. And he did something about it. He took action. Again, aligned with the Father's will He was so aligned that he knew when to take action and when not, and when to intervene and when not to. He didn't have to be that woman or that man or a person in the mourning crowd to understand and to have compassion. It's worth our time to contemplate the depth of relational understanding that God has for you and me in our physical life and in all of our experiences, every one of our experiences. Let's go to Hebrews 4 for our final verse. Hebrews 4, verse 15. Goes back to what we read earlier in Hebrews about him as a high priest. Well, we'll start in verse 14, just to pick up the whole section here. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. And that's more than temptation. That's sympathize with being human, being just existing in this world, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. The context here is kind of, you know, focusing on sin here. I'll quote from one of our booklets, because I think it's a good understanding of this, a succinct understanding of this. This is from the Jesus Christ, the Real Story booklet, page 70. Only the one who successfully prevails against a particular temptation and remains sinless knows the full extent of that temptation. He remains sinless. He went through the entirety of those temptations. We give in often. But he knows the full extent, just as he knows the full extent of what it means to be a human and live in all of these different scenarios in his life, that he can relate and have compassion and understand what we are going through in our lives. When God is moved to compassion at our experiences in this life, he acts in mercy, as it says here, in grace. And in other places, it talks about comfort. So maybe the question that I posed at the beginning is actually the wrong question. Instead of asking how does or how can Jesus relate to me in my situation, maybe we should ask ourselves one of these. How are the sufferings of my life made complete or perfect through Jesus Christ? How does his life and existence, how does it relate to me? Or how do my own experiences relate to the work of God? Knowing that Jesus is the author of my salvation, meaning he paved the way for my salvation, he'd done it already. So how does my experience relate to what the work he's performing in me as the author of my salvation? These are perhaps more complex questions for us to answer, but I think it starts by understanding and believing in faith the fullness of God's humanity and his ability to relate very personally to you and to me.